In 2001, a dismembered body was found in London's Regent's Canal. Inquiries soon led police to one man, 44-year-old tradesman John Sweeney.
He didn't have any particular geographic base, and he didn't have any particular emotional base.
Sweeney's life was dominated by violence and controlling behaviour.
He had the axe over his head ready to finish me off. I put my hands over my face and shut my eyes, ready to die.
She told the sister that if anything ever happened to her, it would be John Sweeney that had done it, and he would leave nothing left behind.
Despite going to extreme lengths to conceal the evidence of his crimes, he celebrated the savage attacks on his victims in his artwork.
They found a most extraordinary array of artwork and poetry of the most dark and sinister nature, which gave some indication of his mentality.
His actions would lead British and European officers on a large-scale hunt for evidence, in a race to convict him before he was free to strike again.
In the last 25 years, I struggle to think of a more dangerous man that has ever come before a court in this country.
I think, without doubt, he's probably one of the most cruel individuals I've ever had the misfortune to come across.
In the mid-1980s, unemployment figures in the UK soared, reaching a record 3 million. Amongst those desperate for work was Liverpudlian carpenter and tradesman John Sweeney. Brought up in Skelmersdale, just outside Liverpool, throughout the early 80s, John Sweeney drifted from job to job on building sites around mainland Europe and the UK, with the itinerant nature of his work seemingly preventing him from putting down any significant roots. In the mid-1980s, he arrived in London, and his fortunes appeared to take an unexpected upturn when he met American model Melissa Halstead in December 1986.
John Sweeney landed on his feet when he came to London, met an attractive American model from Ohio called Melissa, working in the West End, and they started living together in some of the most exclusive areas of London, the King's Road, Sloane Square, Chelsea's finest.
John Sweeney was working as a carpenter, and he was working on a set for a fashion shoot at which Melissa was working as a photographer, and that's where they first met. John had quite a bohemian lifestyle. By that I mean he would draw sketches and they'd smoke cannabis together. So there seemed to be a mutual attraction between the two.
John Sweeney thought that he had an artistic gene in him, which must have attracted Melissa. She was interested in the arts. So they had something in common, and that's what drew them together.
As an American coming to London at that point, you know, where she was living, you know, it would have been a good time for her. She would have missed her family and friends, but, you know, the relationship with John would have been one that she would probably have been satisfied with.
But behind Sweeney's seemingly carefree and bohemian approach to life lay a vicious temper and a sadistic rage, and it wasn't long before this bubbled to the surface of their relationship. A heavy user of drugs and alcohol, Sweeney was a violent and abusive partner. He was convicted twice for assaulting Melissa, describing their relationship as love-hate. To her family, almost 4,000 miles away in the Midwest, the attraction was a mystery. But Melissa assured them it was love. Unwittingly, she had become entangled in the web of one of Britain's most dangerous men.
Melissa's sister came over from America and stayed with them in their Chelsea flat on one occasion. And she witnessed the acrimony within their relationship for herself. She took an instant dislike to John Sweeney and felt that he was not right for her sister.
In 1987, Melissa's UK visa expired. The following year, immigration services caught up with her and she was deported. With her family urging her to escape the controlling clutches of Sweeney, Melissa fled to mainland Europe and moved into a flat in Vienna. But Sweeney would not let go and eventually tracked her down in the Austrian capital.
The love of his life was leaving, and as far as he was concerned, and he didn't really want that relationship to end, so he followed her.
After 2 years together in London, Melissa had the chance to break away from Sweeney once and for all and leave him behind in London. So she took the opportunity to go to Europe. Unfortunately, Sweeney followed her every step of the way.
and Sweeney's barrage of mental and physical abuse continued on the continent. Upon his arrival in Vienna, Sweeney stalked Melissa, finding out where she lived, before breaking into her flat, tying her up and interrogating her. Days later, in a particularly ferocious row, he attacked Melissa with a hammer, cracking her skull, resulting in her requiring emergency surgery.
This was a moment, surely, when he would be put away and she would be free from him.
For the brutal attack on his then-girlfriend, Sweeney was arrested and sentenced to 12 months in an Austrian prison.
Melissa made a number of phone calls to her sister at this time, basically opening her heart about her relationship with John Sweeney. And they were to reveal this horrendous clash in her own mind, whether to stay with the man she had this attraction with, despite the violence, or to sever him from her life once and for all.
It was during this violent and turbulent period of their relationship when Melissa had a conversation with her sister. And she told the sister that if anything ever happened to her, that is Melissa, it would be John Sweeney that had done it, and he would leave nothing left behind.
Despite this seemingly chilling prediction, Melissa, crippled by her fear and anxiety, made an emotional appeal to Austrian authorities for Sweeney's early release.
He actually did manage to control Melissa Halster in a way that she couldn't really have predicted, because having battered her really grievously, he managed to get her to release him from prison by being really charming and sorry.
But she couldn't break away from him, and it was to cost her life.
In 1989, John Sweeney was released early from an Austrian prison following a brutal hammer attack on his American girlfriend, Melissa Halstead. In search of a fresh start, they moved to Amsterdam, and life initially appeared to settle down.
I settled in a flat. Melissa was working. Sweeney gave the impression that he was looking for work. The landlord thought they were model tenants, a nice couple, paid their rent on time, caused no trouble, seemed to get on with everybody.
Later that year, 33-year-old Melissa made a phone call home to her family in America. Tragically for them, no one was home to take the call. What they couldn't have realised was that it would be the last time they would hear from their daughter.
Although Melissa was many miles away from her family, she would always make sure that she would contact her mother on her birthday, and that would have been sometime in November of each year, which she did on the last occasion that she contacted the family, and she left a message on an answer phone to her mum, basically, you know, wishing her a happy birthday.
Hi, Mom, it's Melissa. I just called to wish you a happy birthday. I'm going to be getting a fax machine sometime soon, so I'll call and be able to leave that number with you anyway. Have a good time and take care of yourself. Goodbye, I love you.
Unfortunately, that was the last occasion that the family had any contact with her.
Alone with Sweeney in the Dutch capital, their relationship continued to be dogged by physical abuse and controlling behaviour. But Sweeney's propensity for violence and intimidation towards his partners stretched back to years earlier, and his life as a young husband in the northwest of England.
Well, John Sweeney was from the Liverpool area. He grew up in Skelmersdale, very close to Liverpool. He was in a family with two brothers and a sister. And from our information, he had quite a tyrannical father and very, very strict upbringing.
John Sweeney was a carpenter by trade. He was something of an itinerant Liverpudlian who moved around Europe and the UK. He didn't have any particular geographic base, and he didn't have any particular emotional base. He moved from relationship to relationship, and it didn't really matter what city he happened to be in.
In 1976, aged just 20, John Sweeney returned home to Skelmersdale in Lancashire. There he met and married local woman Anne Bramley. Two children soon followed, but John and Anne's fledgling marriage was an unhappy one from the outset.
Anne Bramley was John Sweeney's first wife. And it was, I think it's fair to say, quite a tempestuous relationship. There's certainly evidence that we uncovered as a result of our inquiries that there was violence within the marriage.
In fact, Sweeney's behaviour was so unstable due to his heavy drinking that Anne had asked him to leave the family home, and she herself had moved out to stay with a friend. But John Sweeney wasn't someone who liked to follow orders.
Anne was at a neighbour's house just for a social visit when they heard a noise next door. An officer attended the property, and on searching the house, John Sweeney jumped out from behind a wardrobe door, brandishing a hammer and an axe. He did it to surprise Anne, so one might think that was quite a surprise she would have got. It's horrifying to think what may have happened if the policeman hadn't been there and it had been Anne that had searched the house on her own.
John Sweeney was immediately arrested at the scene. Terrified, Anne and her young family relocated to a secret location elsewhere in the country. Weeks later, he was found guilty of a breach of the peace and ordered to stay away from Anne. Seemingly accepting defeat, John moved down to London, where he met model Melissa Halstead. Despite being in a relationship filled with explosive violence that resulted in Sweeney's imprisonment, Melissa chose to remain with him on his release. In 1989, they moved to Amsterdam, and their life initially appeared to be less volatile.
She was obviously besotted by him as well. You know, for her to have been significantly attacked by him and receiving significant injuries, and she was still prepared to remain in a relationship with him.
In April 1990, John and Melissa's landlord were surprised to return from his Easter holidays to find their apartment empty.
John and Melissa were now living in Amsterdam in a ground floor apartment. And in April 1990, the landlord had occasion to go round to the flat. And when he entered, having got no reply, the flat had been emptied of both Melissa's and John Sweeney's belongings, and all that remained was a large mirror.
Just a few weeks later, on the 3rd of May, two young boys spotted a duffel bag floating in the Westersingle Canal, almost 60 miles away from Amsterdam in the port city of Rotterdam.
So they rang the police, who attended, and managed to get the holder to the side where it was removed. And as the holder was placed on the side of the canal, there was clearly blood leaking from it, so it was quite obvious that something suspicious was inside. When the holder was opened, there was a dismembered body of a female contained inside, tied up with rope. The body was removed to a local mortuary where a post-mortem examination was conducted.
They wouldn't have had any opportunity at that point to have identified who that individual was. They didn't have any other DNA that they could have matched with it, so they would have taken samples from those remains, and those would have been stored until such time that they had something to compare it with.
With no way of identifying the female found in the canal, the investigation was shelved and the case went cold. 1 month later, police in Amsterdam received a call from Melissa's mother in Ohio. Aware of her daughter's unstable relationship with Sweeney, Melissa's family had grown concerned for her welfare, having not heard from her since the answer phone message left 6 months earlier. Dutch detectives visited their, by now, deserted apartment.
The family were concerned, but they had no means of contacting Melissa, who, as far as they knew, was just somewhere on the other side of the world pursuing whatever she was pursuing, either her modelling or her photography work. Neither did they have any means of contacting John Sweeney. The contact would have had to come from Melissa herself.
The police in Amsterdam then did a thorough forensic search of the address, and that didn't provide any indication whatsoever that any foul play had taken place at the address.
With no evidence of anything untoward happening to Melissa, and without a means of contacting the couple, Dutch police were satisfied no crime had taken place, and their investigations ended. But crucially, Melissa was never reported missing, allowing one of Europe's most dangerous criminals to slip through the net. Unbeknown to Dutch authorities, Melissa's boyfriend, John Sweeney, had fled the country shortly after their landlord had discovered their empty apartment in April 1990. 2 years later, Sweeney resurfaced in London, where he met nurse Delia Barmer in a Camden bar.
It was a bank holiday Monday. I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't usually go to the pub on a Monday. It was very quiet in there. This guy came into the pub. He sat at the other end of the bar and he kept looking at me, and that was John Sweeney. I was trying to avoid looking at him because I didn't want another disaster with another boyfriend. I like guys, but I didn't want to any more disasters, and I tried not to look at him. He said, "Would you like a drink?" And I thought, oh, well, it wouldn't harm just to have one drink.
There was an attraction there. John Sweeney was a bohemian individual. He loved to draw and sketch. Delia would have found this quite attractive because she had quite a bohemian lifestyle herself. Their relationship grew and they became great friends. And a while later, John Sweeney moved into her flat in Kentish Town.
I needed someone because I felt so alone. And I thought he was helping me. I thought he cared and looked after me. And I was alone.
The longer their relationship went on, Dina realised that she'd made a dreadful mistake. John Sweeney developed some rather alarming habits. He used to keep a tarantula spider in a glass tank. And he used to sit and watch the spider for hours.
Before he came and moved in there, I thought, oh, I've got somebody to talk to now and we're going to have such good talks. But it never happened. He'd sit and look at his tarantula and drink pots of tea and smoke joints.
And it wasn't long after moving in together that Sweeney's violent and controlling personality began to reveal itself.
I wasn't allowed out of the flat without him. He was there all the time. He would even follow me to the bathroom and watch me go to the toilet. I thought, even if I think, you'll know what I'm thinking. No, I blocked my mind, because tried to anyway, because I just knew I was in danger.
After 2 years of a psychologically exhausting relationship, Delia finally found the courage to ask Sweeney to leave the flat. Spurned by rejection once more, Sweeney stalked the flat and pounced on Delia.
He had ropes there ready, and he grabbed my arms and he put me back and tied my wrists to the bed. So I was tied to the bed all night long. And he ranted and raved and he had my kitchen knife and his gun hidden nearby. I felt like I was in a padded cell with a complete maniac.
Panicked that Delia's work colleagues might raise the alarm if she failed to arrive for her shift, Sweeney decided to allow Delia to return to work. Living in fear, she decided not to report the incident.
Escape was not an option. I thought about how can I get out, but I thought there's no way. If I try to escape, something is going to happen.
Days after tying Delia to the bed, Sweeney announced that he was returning to Europe for work. Relieved, Delia changed the locks, a move that enraged Sweeney.
I crept into the flat, always afraid that somehow he may still be there. I opened the door to the flat, but I was wary all the time. The door flung open, he came out, he says, "What did you do that for?" He stuck his fingers down my throat and he says, "Are you gonna stop screaming?" And I'd already stopped. I thought, this is it, the knives are in here.
Once again, Delia found herself held hostage in her own home. This time, her work colleagues were concerned for her welfare and contacted the police. As a result, the authorities visited the flat.
The police came. He wouldn't answer, but in the end, he's saying, "Just go to the door and tell them everything is all right, and as soon as we've stopped talking, I'm leaving." I stood up, walked to the door, felt his presence behind me, opened the door, and I rushed out of the door, out into the street.
John Sweeney was arrested for various offences, including assault. When he was removed from the flat by police, Delia pointed out his belongings, and officers behind the bath panel found what can only be described as a killer's kit bag. Contained within it was a tarpaulin rubber sheet, lengths of rope, surgical gloves, and rolls of duct tape. All the things you might need if you were clearing up after a crime scene.
John Sweeney was now safely behind bars, awaiting trial for a terrifying assault on Delia Barmer after holding her hostage in her own flat. But in a cruel twist of fate, he was about to be released back onto the streets.
As it got to towards the end of December 1994, with Christmas approaching, there was an amnesty. Prisoners in custody for certain offences could be released, which would mean they could spend Christmas at home with their families. One such person who benefited from this amnesty was John Sweeney.
Delia's assured beforehand that he wouldn't be getting bail, he'd be inside over Christmas.
Despite a litany of previous convictions for extreme violence, John Sweeney was released, but on strict bail conditions requiring him to go back to Skelmersdale.
I told the police what he would do to me, what time he would do it, when he would be there, and how he would do it. I was given no protection.
On remand and awaiting trial for holding his girlfriend captive in her London home, John Sweeney was unexpectedly released from prison days before Christmas in 1994. As part of his bail conditions, he was required to return to his hometown of Skelmersdale. But Sweeney was not a man who took kindly to orders.
Being someone who would not be told what to do by the law or anyone, he made a beeline straight for Delia with very harmful intent.
On the 22nd of December 1994, a couple of days after John Sweeney was released from prison, Delia was coming home from work on a cold December night at about 6 o'clock. As she climbed the few steps to her flat with her bicycle, Sweeney emerged from underneath the basement.
He says, "Come on in, I want to speak to you." He brings out the axe. First, with the wooden handle of the axe, he bashes me. I put my arms out for protection. With the large wooden handle of the axe, bang here. I tried to kick him, hit him in the right place, but I missed. So with my broken, bleeding arms, I pulled my bicycle on top of me to try and have some protection. Then he stabbed me through this breast into the lung. And then he stabbed me through the thigh.
Delia protected herself by placing her bicycle on top of her, but she could hear the clanging of the axe and the knife as it hit the frame of her bicycle.
He had the axe over his head, ready to finish me off. I put my hands over my face and shut my eyes, ready to die.
Delia's desperate screams alerted the attention of a neighbour.
He came out to see what all the commotion was about, armed with a baseball bat, and he could see Sweeney attacking Delia. He leapt to Delia's defence and attacked Sweeney, hitting him on the back with the baseball bat, which caused Sweeney to flee the scene, leaving Delia fighting for her life.
Following the sustained and brutal attack, Delia suffered near-fatal stab wounds and was rushed to hospital. Sweeney, now on the run, brazenly breached the police order imposed on him over a decade earlier and paid an unbidden visit to his former wife Anne's home.
He stays the night with Anne Bramley, but stayed in his room, kept himself to himself. However, he did tell his son that he'd done things that would make your hair stand on end.
He just turned up on the doorstep. It meant nothing to him. He had no qualms at all about imposing himself for one night on a family that would probably be absolutely in shock to see him.
Following the attack on Delia, there was an active manhunt to track down John Sweeney, who they knew was armed and extremely dangerous. They visited the family home in Skelmersdale, but he'd already fled and he wasn't there. After a while, the trail ran cold, and the whereabouts of John Sweeney wasn't known.
Yet again, Sweeney went to ground and had managed to evade capture.
While Sweeney was on the run, he did a number of different jobs, working as a workman on building sites. He had no national insurance number. He was paid in cash, so he could move from job to job.
But with Delia now recovered and able to provide police with more information, the investigation into Sweeney was to unearth terrifying new revelations about his past.
What she told them was she'd seen a picture of a young woman in John Sweeney's belongings.
He says, "Oh, that was my American girlfriend, Melissa."
And John Sweeney told her that he came home one day, found her in bed with two German men, so he shot all three of them.
He said, "I didn't know what to do with the bodies, so I sat with them for 3 days. On the third day, I cut them up and threw them in the canal."
Following Delia's shocking testimony, detectives from the Metropolitan Police immediately alerted their Dutch counterparts. To their disbelief, police in the Netherlands confirmed that they did have a record of a body discovered in a Rotterdam canal in 1990. And alarmingly, they also revealed that a second body was discovered in near identical circumstances in Amsterdam 2 years later. Detectives now asked if this could be the remains of the still-missing Melissa Halstead, last seen in Amsterdam in 1990. And what's more, could the two deaths be the work of the same killer?
In 1992, another dismembered female body in a suitcase is found in an Amsterdam canal. The body was completely dismembered in several parts, and the hands haven't been fully removed from the body. The fingertips were removed.
With the discovery of the dismembered body in Amsterdam appearing to confirm what Delia had told police, Dutch authorities contacted Melissa's family in Ohio to request a familial DNA sample, allowing them to determine whether the profile matched that of the dismembered body.
The DNA was sent from America to the Netherlands, but unfortunately the samples were negative. So the Amsterdam police thought they may have solved the riddle of the dismembered female body from 1992, but unfortunately that wasn't the case.
The result was a bitter setback for the family of Melissa Halstead, and her disappearance remained a mystery. In February 2001, 6 years after John Sweeney's brutal attack on Delia Barmer, and in a macabre reminder of events in Holland a decade earlier, three young boys fishing on London's Regent's Canal made a harrowing discovery.
They come across some hold alls within the canal, and obviously once police are called to the scene, it's established that they actually contain the remains of an unidentified female.
Apart from the one holdall that the boys have fished onto the side, they find five others. All six holdalls contain a total of 10 body parts. The body parts have been weighed down in the holdalls with various bricks, ceramic tiles, and other various wrappings. The holdalls and their contents are taken to the local mortuary where they're examined. And they're found to be the various body parts of a young female. The head, the hands, and the feet are all missing.
Metropolitan Police immediately launched a murder inquiry, and a DNA sample was checked against the National DNA Database. Shortly after, the body was formally identified as 31-year-old Liverpudlian woman Paula Fields.
Paula Fields was a lovely woman. She was brought up in Merseyside and came to London, as so many people do from the north and other parts of the country, believing this was where her future lay, and with money and the great excitement that London was to produce. Unfortunately, she hit a spiral of drugs and prostitution, and despite three children, she found herself in despair. When Paula went missing, the police looked into her background and lifestyle, and found that among her friends was a man called Joe Scouse.
Whilst in London, Paula met a man called Joe, also from Merseyside. They got on well, both being from the same area. They clearly liked each other's company. However, there were times when Joe would lose patience with Paula. He talked about having lost his mobile phone and money. He would challenge Paula about it, but she would deny it. There was another occasion when Paula would buy drugs from a dealer in the street, and rather than pay the dealer, she would say that Joe would pay, which upset him greatly.
Owing to her sometimes chaotic lifestyle, it was not unusual for Paula to go missing from time to time. But her family grew increasingly concerned when she failed to make contact with them over Christmas in 2000. Police now wondered if Paula's body had been in the canal longer than they had first realised, and tracking down Joe Scouse became their number one priority.
Paula's associates and friends revealed that Joe Scouse was living at a house in Digby Crescent, Finsbury Park.
The initial inquiries weren't able to identify who this person called Joe Scouse was. At Digby Crescent, there was a male who had also been spoken to, and that individual was somebody called Anthony Sweeney.
Anthony Sweeney was placed under observation by undercover officers as they couldn't be sure that he wasn't actually Joe Scouse.
Whilst under observation, he met with another man Officers were surprised to learn that this other man was in fact Anthony's brother, John. Having run John Sweeney's details through the national computer, they were amazed to find that John Sweeney was in fact wanted for the attack on Delia Bowmer in 1994 and had been on the run for over 5 years.
While Sweeney was on the run, he used a number of aliases. He did a number of different jobs, one of which happened to be at a building site very close to the Old Bailey.
The hunt for Paula's killer was almost over. And 6 years on from the brutal attack on Delia, detectives were about to discover the true scale of Sweeney's violent and murderous past. Investigators waited for an opportune moment to pounce, seizing 45-year-old John Sweeney when he made an appointment at a mobile phone shop.
Once Sweeney had been arrested, police went to search his property. They found a selection of guns, ammunition, a machete, a garrote, a wig. It seemed like the everyday arsenal of weaponry of a very violent and dangerous man.
In 2001, John Sweeney was charged with the attempted murder of Delia Bowmer, along with firearms offences in relation to the weapons found at his bedsit. He was also arrested on suspicion of the murder of Paula Fields.
He admitted that he knew Paula and admitted that on occasions their relationship had been quite violent. There was some evidence in the bricks that had been used to weigh down the body parts in the holdalls. The soil samples that were contained on the bricks were compared to the garden in Digby Crescent, and there was some evidence that that soil could have come from the garden, which would have provided a physical link between Sweeney and Paula.
The case against John Sweeney was significantly difficult. In a lot of murder investigations, you have lots of evidence at your disposal that you can use to confirm whether someone's been involved in the offence or not. But in this case, we didn't have a crime scene. We didn't know where she was killed, and we didn't know how she was killed. We didn't have any CCTV evidence, therefore, to link to that murder. We didn't have any other opportunities in terms of significant witnesses who would have witnessed the assault or the aftermath.
Not satisfied that police had done enough to build the case against Sweeney, the Crown Prosecution Service made the decision not to charge him with the murder of Paula Fields.
Sadly, the investigation into Paula's death stalled. There were no further lines of inquiry, and the case was closed.
John Sweeney was found guilty of the attempted murder of Delia Bowmer and given a life sentence with a minimum tariff of just 9 years, meaning he would be eligible for parole in April 2011.
All they gave him was 9 years and 1 month after all the hell I had been through. And I'm the one who's being punished. I've got this pain, scars, everything for the rest of my life.
As police began piecing together who exactly John Sweeney was, they searched a number of properties in London and Liverpool, as well as his jail cell at Gartree Prison in Leicestershire. What they found offered an alarming insight into the depraved mind of Sweeney and provided investigators with potential new clues as to what had happened to Melissa Halstead, who'd been missing since 1990.
They found a most extraordinary array of artwork and poetry of the most dark and sinister nature. There was pictures of Sweeney, self-portraits labelled Scalp Hunter, portrayed as a devil with a blood-soaked axe.
And a lot of these drawings and sketches and poems were specifically about both Delia and Melissa. And they were very enlightening to police because when you looked at them more closely, some of them also contained what appeared to be messages. For example, one picture had correction fluid on it, but then when you looked underneath it, it had Melissa, born 1956, and then died, and a blank. How did Sweeney know she died? Only the killer would know that.
John Sweeney's painting of the romantic weekend in Vienna is clearly a reference to himself and Melissa. It shows extreme violence and it shows the actual relationship. And in fact, the portrayals, you know, silhouetted, do look like Sweeney and Melissa at that time.
But the most significant piece of evidence they found was a scrap of paper that appeared to have a poem written on it.
His poetry included the most callous rhymes. He wrote about Melissa being fed to the fishes, chopped into bits. Amsterdam was the pits. Most sinister and childlike rhyming with a macabre touch to it.
They're not lyrically brilliant. However, they mention specific cities and locations so that you could piece together the real-world movements of John Sweeney and Melissa.
Despite finding such taunting clues within Sweeney's disturbing artwork, Melissa's case fell outside of the Metropolitan Police's jurisdiction, and British detectives were unable to make any further inquiries into her disappearance. Having evaded capture for 5 years, in 2001, John Sweeney was finally locked up for a frenzied attack on Delia Barmer. Despite suspicions that he was responsible for the death of Paula Fields, police had failed to find enough forensic evidence to build a case against him. But in 2008, and with Sweeney's prison term nearing its end, the Metropolitan Police received an unexpected phone call.
In 2008, I was at my desk and the phone rang. When I answered, it was a detective from Holland, and he told me that he was part of a newly formed cold case investigation team in Rotterdam. He also went on to tell me that due to a particular case they'd been given, which was a dismembered female body found in a canal in Rotterdam in 1990, they'd managed to find a blood sample that had been taken from that post-mortem of that body. When they ran a search through their newly formed missing person databases, that blood sample came back as belonging to Melissa Halstead.
That was a significant turning point in their missing person inquiry, and significant for us in the Metropolitan Police in that we were able to then confirm that there was a link between Melissa Halstead and the murder of Paula Fields, which had been unsolved some years earlier.
And that link was John Sweeney. Unbelievably, the truth about Melissa's fate had been sat on a police DNA database for nearly 20 years. It had only been tested against the body pulled from the Amsterdam waters because there had been nothing to link her to Rotterdam at the time of her disappearance.
On hearing that Melissa's remains had finally been identified, we were quite euphoric in the thought that we could use each case to bolster the other, bearing in mind we had very little physical evidence to go on to prove that John Sweeney murdered either of these women. But of course, we had a problem because we had one victim in London, which was within our jurisdiction, and we had a second victim in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, which clearly wasn't.
In a landmark international murder investigation, British and Dutch police joined forces to build the case against Sweeney.
There had been occasions when different police forces had worked in people trafficking, drugs and firearms offences. It was the first time that we had a UK force investigating a murder investigation with an outside agency.
With Sweeney's release date fast approaching, time was running out for police, and they faced a race to gather evidence against him before he was once again free to roam the streets.
The clock was ticking, and it meant that we had to therefore do an awful lot of things very quickly. But that investigation was fairly complex, because the last thing we wanted him to do is to be released in relation to him serving his sentence for the attempted murder of Delia Barmer. And he's therefore free to possibly attack another female. Then you can just see the repercussions and what would have been in the media.
It was clear from the outset that there were going to be lots of challenges ahead. For example, we don't speak Dutch. The nature of the evidence in the Dutch inquiry in relation to Melissa Halstead, it needed to be translated into English, and there was a huge amount of material. And also it had to be presented in such a way that it would be acceptable in a UK court.
The Dutch authorities had to give us complete ownership of it. So in other words, they had to hand over their investigation, which created its own problems. They would say, well, what happens if you don't do a good job in investigating our case and we have lost the opportunities?
The trial at the Old Bailey began in March 2011, just a few weeks before John Sweeney was eligible for parole. He was charged with 2 counts of murder and 1 of perverting the course of justice by disposing of Paula's body in the Regent's Canal. He pleaded not guilty.
We were reasonably confident. You can never be 100% sure that your case is absolutely watertight and that you will get a conviction.
What were the chances of somebody having a girlfriend who was found dismembered in a canal? Once, you would say that person is pretty unfortunate. For a second time, you would say, what are the chances of that happening to somebody on 2 occasions?
However, we were acutely aware that we had no physical forensic evidence or any significant forensic evidence with which to link John Sweeney to both killings of Paula Fields and Melissa Halstead.
Despite his denial, ultimately it was Sweeney's own artwork that proved damning.
In the cold light of a courtroom, John Sweeney's artwork began to look very different. Clearly, it correlated very well with many of the actual activities around the killings and many of the kind of products of those killings, i.e. the dismembered bodies themselves. John Sweeney had perhaps revealed too much in his little ramblings and his little jokes to himself in his drawings.
From the moment the jury saw the artwork, they knew that whatever he said in his defence, that they were sitting opposite a seriously, seriously dangerous man.
Ultimately, there's no doubt at all that in the context of the case, they did prove to be his downfall. And although he'd never admit it, I'm sure that he regrets bitterly ever drawing them.
After a trial lasting 4 weeks, John Sweeney was found guilty of all charges and ordered to serve a whole life tariff, meaning he will spend the rest of his life in prison.
John Sweeney had always convinced himself throughout that he would never be convicted of this heinous crime. However, he did not contemplate the determination and the resolve of the joint investigation team.
John Sweeney received a whole life tariff, and not that many people do. He was so brutal and so ungiving and consistently so throughout his life.
It's never right to say that you're happy when a person is convicted. I think the word is satisfied, that the culmination of all our hard work and the hard work of our Dutch colleagues had all been supported by the jury in reaching that verdict. But I think most of all, I was satisfied for the friends and the family of both Melissa Halstead and Paula Fields.
We know she is never coming back, and we never said goodbye. We hope to God that John Sweeney will never be released.
It must be very upsetting and distressing for both families to know that certain body parts are missing and will probably never be found. But I think this really shows the control and the contempt that Sweeney has shown over his victims.
Whilst John Sweeney is now behind bars, some detectives believe he is responsible for more as yet unsolved crimes and that he may have killed others.
And as John Sweeney contemplates a life behind bars, I would like to assure him that this investigation will continue as we seek to identify and trace other possible victims within the UK, Holland, and across Europe.
It could be wider than Mark. I take the view that he's probably done others, but I think he'll take that to his grave.
He's shown no remorse or sympathy for his victims. And I think, without doubt, he's probably one of the most cruel individuals I've ever had the misfortune to come across.
In the last 25 years, I struggle to think of a more dangerous man that has ever come before a court in this country.
There's no such thing as justice. I'm the one in pain. I'm the one with the scars. There's no such thing as closure.